with his own enormous seminal and generative power, and the inflation of that. So I pay a lot of attention to feelings in dreams, and I find, and also a lot to the attitude of the ego in the dream itself. Now, I make a distinction between that and the feeling we have after we wake from a dream. Suppose you have a dream in which you kill someone, and in the dream you don't feel guilty about it at all, but you wake up and start thinking about your dream, and you say, oh my God, I killed someone in my dream last night. Well, those feelings belong to the waking ego. And I'm glad the waking ego has a conscience, but that may not be getting what the dream is trying to say. The dream may be saying you have to bring something to an end. You have to bring the life of something to an end. It might be saying it's time to end that relationship. I don't think it literally means killing another person, but it can mean being more aggressive than you naturally would be. And if the dream ego feels okay about that, that's worth listening to. As perhaps the symbolic statement that you have to use your capacity not just to keep something alive, but to bring it to an end. And that can be important. Most of all, it's very important to be able to find in the dream where the self feels violated or intruded upon in a rather fundamental way. Because most of us have a problem with self-realization precisely to the degree that we have bought into, or as the Freudian analysts say, introjected, certain attitudes either from others or from the culture that really injure ourselves. So what I'd like to do, since we have enough time to do it, is read you a verbatim transcript of me working with the dream of a patient that has various kinds of self-symbolism and self-experience embedded in it, so that you can see how I might actually work. Now, I'm lucky to have this particular transcript. It came about in the following way. A friend of mine, a woman named Gail Delaney, some of you may have found some of her books on dreams, asked me if I would contribute a chapter to a book she was writing, and my chapter was to be on the Jungian way of working with dreams. But the rule was that all the contributors to the book had to supply a verbatim sample of their dream work. So I happened to have in my practice at that time a particularly gifted dreamer, a man that I'd learned a great deal from because he was a great dreamer and he was good at working with his own dreams. He taught me a lot about working with dreams, actually. And he was, at the time I was seeing him, really able to afford to come in only a couple of times a month. He was on state-supported medical care, Medi-Cal in San Francisco, and I felt that if I offered him an additional session that could be taped, that he would probably like the chance to talk about one of his dreams, and he seemed far enough along in working with dreams that I thought it might be useful. So he happily accepted the invitation, and he promised to bring me a dream that I had never seen. Moreover, the dream that he brought was dreamed a couple of weeks before I made the request. It was simply a dream that he had forgotten to bring to a previous session. So this was a dream that wasn't in response to the request for a taped dream. And so I can't, of course, just give you the dream without saying something about the dreamer. He was a 48-year-old man whom I'd been seeing in psychotherapy since 1972. So that was 13 years at the time of his dream, which was early 1985. At the time of his entrance into treatment, he was struggling with the emotional consequences of much split-off rage at a sociopathic homosexual partner. That was the presenting problem back in 72. My patient was himself a high-minded, unusually nurturant person, a gay man with a long pattern of being bullied by others, and our first work involved connecting him with his own self-worth and with a number of dream indications to him that he needed to take better care of himself. This was a patient who once had he was very interested in Jungian analysis, and I once asked him about his payment to me, because he didn't sound to me like he had very much money. He said, oh no, it's an energy exchange. But then he had a dream in which his Aunt Violet was making the letter A. And he worked on the dream. I could make no sense of it. Vitamin A. He needed more vitamin A in his diet. He did have a rather sallow complexion, and I wondered about that. He then told me. I asked him what he ate, and he said, well, you know, because I'm in analysis, I have to pay for analysis, I eat every other day. Oh. I don't know if I've ever felt worse in my life. I mean, I was just completely blindsided by that. He had sort of won me over with it. And so that was how we evolved, that he would see me every other week and work on getting public assistance and other things that would make it possible for him to see me and so forth and so on. And, so that tells you a lot about who he was and how generous he was and how... He told me that every year in San Francisco, in the old buildings, and many of the buildings are old Victorian houses and flats, and I guess he lived in a flat in an older house, there will be an invasion of ants every winter when it gets particularly cold. The ants come inside. And he would turn on his water faucet and say to them, welcome, and give the ants water. I mean, this was who he was. I mean, he was... So, I'm sorry to say that perhaps not surprising, seeing how welcoming he was to things that might not be good for him, that he was also perhaps the first or second of my patients to get HIV. And so first there was a yeast infection, and that suggested immune system suppression, and then he developed pneumocystis pneumonia, and the diagnosis was made. And now we were working under the threat of death, and in these early years of the AIDS epidemic, really, only 6 years after the first cases were being reported, and wondering if there was anything that we could do in the analysis to increase his chance of survival. So there was that Simonton idea about cancer in the picture. He had at one time been married, and his daughter had given him the Simonton books. And so we were pushed, at least I felt pushed, in a somewhat heroic direction to see if I could do whatever I could do in the analysis to strengthen him. Is there anything in the psyche that would make a difference? And I was aware that people with all kinds of cancer who have a difficulty expressing anger and are too nice often are the ones that have the quickest and earliest deaths, or at least that was the story that was told to me by various analysts in a few studies. The person on the ward who all the nurses say a prince of a fellow is often the one that dies the quickest, whereas that mean lady who sasses out the nurses on every occasion often lives the longest. So I began to feel that my patient was a little too much like the Prince of Othello for, and that was already the pattern when he went in the hospital with the pneumocystis. So I wanted to mobilize his anger as never before, because he had certain things in life to be angry about. So I was gunning for bear. I was looking for every opportunity. Moreover, the unconscious itself had been supporting this direction in the therapeutic work. For instance, we had had a recent dream that he might be setting some limits on the good part of himself. In the last scene of the dream, that had been discussed already in an analysis, I am alone on the bed with a little baby lying on her back looking up at me. I believe it is my youngest sister, Kathy. I begin to pinch her breasts. I am rather horrified at what I'm doing and begin to pinch even harder. Now, this was quite unlike this man. This man was so incapable of sadism, it was frightening. And so we had to work on what this dream might mean. And it seemed to me that Kathy might represent his passive, immature femininity. And this is not mature enough to nurture him, and he's appropriately angry at that, because it's an anima that's not taking care of him. The associations about the real-life sister revealed her to be self-effacing and dangerously deferential, exactly like that part of himself. And you could say that her emotional stance, like his, did not seem to include a working sense of evil. So I felt the dream had used her to point out a style of emotional expression, what Jung would call an anima, that was still immature and vulnerable because it didn't contain enough trickster meanness. This man was a little too saintly for this world. And I concluded that the dream ego persisted in punishing this figure, even though it felt bad about doing so, because the self had decided it was time to direct some malice toward this excessively passive anima. That's what I thought was going on.